Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to Hollywood Crime Scene. This is Rachel Fisher.
Hi, this is Desi Jadakin. Here we are.
Hey, it's your week.
It's my week.
What are we getting into?
Well, I changed my story again last minute.
Wow, Desi.
I had like 5 things cooking.
I know.
And I could not decide. And I had to make a decision, obviously, because I was like, well, I got to do something. So today we are going to cover the case of Lucille Miller.
Who the hell is that?
She was a housewife and mother who was convicted of the first degree murder of her husband, Gordon Cork Miller. His nickname is Cork.
Why?
Just FYI. I have no idea, actually. I never saw it come up.
No one explained that?
Maybe it's like Corky. Cork.
Cork. Cork.
I don't know. It's just like of that time, you know, people just got weird nicknames. So this is such a Southern California story that it is even the subject of a very famous Joan Didion essay from 1966 titled Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream. And this was included in her iconic 1968 book, Slouching Towards Bethlehem. If you need a Hollywood connection, we got that too. Prosecutors allege that Lucille was inspired by the plot device in the film Double Indemnity. If you don't remember, that's a provision in which the proceeds of a life insurance policy pay double the face value for accidental deaths. So,
and we did an episode about Double Indemnity.
We did about the crime that inspired Double Indemnity.
The movie.
Yes. So this is post that movie.
Right.
So this was a sensational story in trial at the time. There's lots of scandalous reveals, and it's remained a topic of conversation on crime-related message boards to this day, partially because there are still some doubts as to what exactly really happened. Regardless of what went down, it is definitely a family tragedy. This is a classic family that seemed to have it all, achieving not only the American dream, but the California dream. So as we've seen before, things are not often what they appear to be in this perfect suburban family. So sources for this include the Joan Didion essay, which is basically a true crime piece.
Yeah.
Like this is one of her first big pieces. There was an episode of Crime to Remember I watched on the case that had interviews with the children of Lucille. I also read some work by Lucille's daughter, Debbie. She wrote 2 pieces for the LA Times entitled A Mother's Crime. And I thought Joan Didion's essay would ruin my life, but something else happened.
What?
That's the title.
Wait, that's the name of the...
That's the name of one of her essays.
Oh.
So, and I looked at a bunch of old newspapers and listened to some other interviews that were here and there. The daughter is a writer. She's actually a good writer.
Yeah.
And I think she is working on a book. She's like in her 70s now. So I'm not sure. I did try to see if anything had happened, but I think she's still finishing it up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's that. So on the night of October 7th, 1964, 34-year-old Lucille Miller went to the kitchen to make her husband Cork some hot chocolate. Unfortunately, they were low on milk, and Lucille realized they would have none for breakfast in the morning for their 3 kids. But it was nearing midnight, so the options to get some were very limited. Luckily, there was this 24-hour Mayfair market that was open all night, obviously, and even though it was a little bit of a drive, she decided to make the trip. Lucille was a nervous driver, and Cork agreed to go with her, even though he was practically falling asleep on the sofa at the time. They got in the car and took the dark and desolate Banyan Street to the market. Cork stayed in the car while Lucille went in and got the milk. And by the time she came back, he was deep asleep, leaning on the door so much that Lucille locked it just to be sure it didn't open when she was driving. Back on Banyan Street around 12:30 a.m., their 1964 Volkswagen suddenly veered off the road, came to a sudden stop, and caught fire. Unable to get her husband out, Lucille ran up and down Banyan Street trying to get help, but she was basically surrounded by lemon groves. That was it. The nearest house was nowhere to be seen. For over an hour, she tried to get help to no avail until reaching a home and calling the police. By 3 a.m., the fire was finally out, and Lucille was back on the scene with a friend who was called to be with her. Sobbing and inconsolable, Lucille was heard saying to her friend, "What will I tell the children when there's nothing left? There's nothing left in the casket. How can I tell them there's nothing left?" Her husband of 15 years had been burned alive on a mundane outing for milk, but telling her children the news was about to be the least of Lucille's problems. Early on, investigators began to question if Lucille was really the loving mother and wife she claimed to be. So, some background. Lucille was born in Winnipeg on January 17, 1930, into a Seventh-day Adventist family, which meant a very strict upbringing. No makeup, no jewelry, no smoking, drinking, fun, nothing. We've talked about this before, I think. We've had some cases where someone was a member of this church. I can't remember who. So at some point, her family moves to Washington State, where her parents were both teachers at Walla Walla College, which is also a Seventh-day Adventist-related college. So naturally, Lucille went there when she turned 18. She didn't exactly have movie star looks, but she had style and she had dreams, not of making it in Hollywood, but of having that Golden State life, possibly moving to California one day and living the dream. Whatever she did, she knew she wanted out of the life she had been living with her parents. According to her father, Lucille wanted to see the world. And I guess she found out.
Does he?
That's what he said.
Oh, that's
what the dad said. I didn't say that.
I'm sorry.
But I would have said it, to be fair to you.
That is, wow.
Yeah. So in the spring of 1949, Lucille met and married Gordon Cork Miller, a 24-year-old graduate of Walla Walla and the University of Oregon Dental School. He was stationed at Fort Lewis as a medical officer at the time. According to Lucille's dad, maybe you could say it was love at first sight. Before they were ever formally introduced, Cork had sent Lucille a dozen and a half roses with a card that said, even if she didn't come out on a date with him, he hoped she'd find the roses pretty anyway. So they get hitched, and according to the dad, his daughter was a radiant bride. After getting married, Lucille fulfilled a bit of her dream to see the world. They first lived in Guam while Cork finished his military duties, and then they were off to Oregon for a bit, where Cork set up a private dental practice. At this point, Cork decides that he wants to be a doctor rather than a dentist, so he enrolls into Seventh-day Adventist College of Medical Evangelists at Loma Linda, which is a few miles south of San Bernardino. Lucille was finally making her way to California, even if it was the less glamorous area in SoCal. She would be the queen of the Inland Empire. So she also was kind of like, well, it's just while he attends this medical school.
Did she want to go to LA eventually?
I don't even know. Yeah. I mean, just something better than that.
San Bernardino, by the way, is the county right next to Los Angeles.
Yes. In between here and like Palm Springs.
And kinda. Riverside.
Well, isn't Riverside kind of San Bernardino, Riverside? They're all right there, aren't they?
Is that in San Bernardino County or Riverside County?
They're right next to each other.
Yeah, it's like that whole...
Yeah,
it's... Please, I'm so sorry. I'm usually pretty good at geography, but not
it's
right
fine.
Now.
Anyway, Didion got really dragged for her description of San Bernardino in the essay. In it, she said... San Bernardino was a place of teased hair and capris and the girls for whom all life's promise comes down to a waltz-length white wedding dress and the birth of a Kimberly or a Sherry or a Debbie.
Damn.
Then a Tijuana divorce and return to the hairdresser school.
Honestly, the teased hair and capris sounds really cute.
Honestly, this is my type of girl. We know this.
These are the girls that were my friends in high school.
Yeah, I want a woman who names their daughter Debbie.
Yeah.
As a friend. Yeah. That's someone you can count on.
For sure.
So one of the people most up by this description later on will be Lucille Miller, because she did not see herself that way. But Cork quickly ended up dropping out of medical school. He bought a nearby dental practice, and they got a modest house in 1957. By the summer of 1964, they had continued moving up the social ladder. They got a bigger house that was on a better street, and they now had three children. Lucille was making a mark on the small but dedicated San Bernardino social scene as well, often appearing in the newspaper with titles like Mrs. Gordon Miller, the Ontario Heart Fund Chairman. So she was making a little splash on the scene. But the stress of all this moving up was causing fractures in the marriage. Despite some wins, 1964 had been rough. In April, Lucille's closest friend, Elaine Hayton, died suddenly. Lucille had been with her the night before she was found dead in bed the next morning. In May, the stress of all of this financial debt got to Cork Miller, and he was hospitalized briefly with a bleeding ulcer. This health crisis deepened the moody man's depression. He told his accountant that he was sick of looking at open mouths, and he began openly talking about suicide. So let's talk a little bit about Cork's depression and suicidal thoughts. This was a constant in the family's life, and every family member had experience with it. On the documentary I watched, Ronan, one of the sons, spoke of an incident where the dad took him and his other brother out to like this outdoor location with some big rocks that they were like sitting on. And seemingly out of nowhere, he said to the boys that they should know that if he were to ever die one day, they would all be in heaven together, which he was creeped out by.
Yeah.
And it's creepy. The oldest daughter, Debbie, really took a lot of the burden on because her mom basically confided in her about all of this stuff. She actually made Debbie her ally in this fight to keep Cork from killing himself.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's really bad. In several interviews with Debbie and in her essay, she tells this harrowing story about her mom at one point. After she heard them fighting, her mom ran into her and said, "Go get the car keys, take them with you in your bedroom and lock the door." Because the dad was threatening to kill himself in a car accident. She stayed in her room, petrified, clutching the keys, waiting for the screaming to stop. And her dad, thankfully, never came to her room to fight for the keys, but she was like bracing for it. This threat of suicide by car accident was not a one-time thing. Deborah was under the impression that her father wanted his suicide to look like an accident in order to provide for his family one last time with an insurance payout. This threat was so frequent that when Debbie realized something had happened the morning after the accident, she asked her mom, "Did he kill himself?"
Oh my God.
So a major part of his anxiety and depression was that he resented being tied to this career that he hated in order to pay for 8488 Bella Vista Drive, which was this new big house they had. Their daughter, Deborah, recalled that her father wanted to be an airline pilot but had reluctantly followed her grandfather into dentistry in order to not have his college funding cut off. So this is not an uncommon story. We hear a lot about men, especially during these days, where they kind of get a lot of this pressure to be this provider and can't kind of... We've discussed this type of guy before.
Yeah.
And it's sad. So by July 8th, things had gotten so bad between the Millers that Lucille actually filed for divorce. But they saw a marriage counselor and they reconciled after a month. Joan Didion described it in her essay this way: "It seemed that the marriage had reached the traditional truce, the point at which so many resigned themselves to cutting both their losses and their hopes." Just like the
Damn,
most depressing.
That's so sad.
Sad. So the family got through the summer and began the new school year. Things are business as usual. Everyone's back in their roles, pretending to be the perfect family again. And on October 7th, that was a normal day for the most part as well. It was unusual only because the kids actually were at home that day from school due to a teacher retreat day, and it was really hot. The temperatures reached 102 degrees. Lucille ran errands, but perhaps the first sign that the day's vibes were off was that Cork hit and killed a dog on his way home from work with the Volkswagen.
Aww.
Afterwards, he began complaining of a migraine, saying his head felt like it was hit by a Mack truck, which was also something he said a lot. Now, migraines had become very common for Cork. The stress of this debt plus all the other stuff was really starting to kind of tear his body apart. Everything about his life felt oppressive. And by this point, he had been self-prescribing barbiturates to himself to take the edge off.
Migraines are so serious.
Yeah. I mean, even a headache is can like ruin your day. And migraines are literally like,
I mean,
yeah, a million times worse.
Yeah. It's not just like, oh, my head really, really hurts. It's like, you can't, like you can't even have light.
Yes. So yeah, he's really suffering. The night was also pretty typical. Cork ate alone in the living room using a TV tray, which I was like, why don't we bring back TV trays? I want one.
Can we please bring back the TV trays? It was like they just completely left after the 1990s.
They're amazing. And I know you can get them vintage, but it's like, why not just, let's just make them again.
I just mean as like a common occurrence, because I remember using them at my best friend's house when I'd have dinner at her house, like if her parents weren't home and it was just her babysitter, and we'd have the TV trays and we'd like watch whatever.
It's so much nicer than just putting your plate on the coffee table.
Yeah.
I think. Anyway, they later watched a movie together, and at some point Cork requested this hot chocolate. That's when Louise discovered they needed milk. According to Louise, she was afraid to go alone, so that's why Cork went with her, but it was obviously too drunk to drive, so he took a blanket and pillow from the couch, climbed into the passenger seat, and they drove off into the night. By the time she left the Mayfair Market, and long before they reached Banyan Street, Cork Miller appeared to be asleep, and that's when Lucille remembers locking the door. What happened next gets a little fuzzy in Lucille's accounting of the story. She said that she was driving east on Banyan Street at about 35 miles per hour when she felt the Volkswagen pull sharply to the right. The next thing she knew, the car was on the embankment quite near the edge of this retaining wall, and flames were shooting up behind her. She doesn't remember jumping out or prying up a stone, which she said she used to try to break the window next to her husband. And then she scrambled down the retaining wall to try to find a stick. She said, I don't know how I was going to push him out. I just thought if I had a stick, I could push him out, but she couldn't. And after a while, she ran into the intersection. As I mentioned earlier, there were no houses at that corner and almost no traffic. She did say she saw one car pass by, but they didn't stop. She then ran back down Banyan toward the burning Volkswagen, but she said she didn't stop. She slowed down, and in the flame, she could see her husband, and he was just, according to her, just black. Now, interestingly enough, this is not the first accident Lucille had been in on Banyan Street. In June of that year, an older man had run the stop sign on Banyan and one of the Banyan intersections and hit Lucille's car. Debbie was also with her. Debbie flew out the windshield and ended up with 50 stitches in her face, and Lucille broke her jaw.
Oh my God.
Obviously, this was not a seatbelt wearing day. Neither one of them were wearing their seatbelt. A woman appeared from inside a nearby house and called an ambulance. Debbie was obviously distraught after the accident and talked to her dad about this anxiety she felt. She said, according to her, I asked Daddy what the odds were that our family would ever have an accident on that street again. And he said that would be almost impossible. Now, it is speculated that Lucille in her days was trying to find the house from the day of that first accident, but went the wrong way. She does eventually happen across a house, which was about a half a mile from where the fire was. They called the sheriff and a close family friend named Harold Lance, who was also an attorney, to come get Lucille. Now, Harold Lance and Lucille returned to Banyan Street where the accident happened to talk to highway patrol officers, and they would go back to the house. Then a third time, Harold Lance returned alone, and when he came back, he said to Lucille Miller, okay, you don't talk anymore. Now, by this point, the investigators began to notice some things that were inconsistent with her story. For instance, the skid marks the car made weren't really lining up with what she said had happened. The car was still in low gear, which was unusual for going 35 miles per hour, which I guess is not first gear. I've never driven stick, so I don't know. And they also noticed that the wheels seemed to have dug in at some point, implying that someone had maybe tried to push the car over the embankment. The biggest red flag, however, was that there was an empty can of gasoline lying on its side in the back seat. Adding to this red flagginess, the charred milk cartons that she claimed to have bought that night were still standing upright and apparently not at all jostled by what Lucille described as a sudden stop. So why would they still be up but the gas can tipped over? Mm. At 8488 Bella Vista, Lucille, when she finally went home, was a mess. She called a woman named Sandy Slagle to come be with her. Sandy was the family's babysitter and kind of like a family member at this point. They had basically saved her from a difficult situation at her home, and Sandy described Lucille as having the most wonderful character of anyone she had ever known. They were so close that Debbie was actually jealous of their tight-knit relationship. When Sandy arrived, she saw a doctor giving Lucille a shot of Nebutol. She said that she was crying as she was going under, and over she'd say, "Sandy, all the hours I spent trying to save him, and now what are they trying to do to me?" Sandy was confused, but by 1:30 p.m., she understood all too well what Lucille meant. Sergeant William Peterson and Detectives Charles Callahan and Joseph Carr of the Central Homicide Division arrived at the home. One of them appeared at the bedroom door and said to Sandy, "Go get Lucille. You've got 10 minutes to get her dressed, or we'll take her exactly as she is." So at this point, she's in a nightgown. So Sandy's trying to get her dressed. She had bras and panties on her, and they threw the door open and said, "Get some capris on her, get a scarf, and get her out of here." And they just took her.
They knew what capris were?
Oh, wait. Sandy said that she got capris. This is Sandy's explanation. The cops knew what capris were.
The cops were like, "Get her in a sickening little outfit.
Get her in a scarf, tie it up, make it look sharp." We want her to slay.
Yeah.
Lucille was under arrest. So just 12 hours after the first report of this, they're taking her into the police station.
Wow.
The investigators had the initial inconsistencies I mentioned, and they had more questions for Lucille. Namely, why was Cork unconscious at the time of the accident, and why did it take Lucille so much time to get help? They were also struck by Harold Lance's attitude the time that he came back to the scene alone. He seemed annoyed they were still investigating. According to a prosecuting attorney, he would later say that the way Lance was acting, they thought maybe they had hit a nerve with him, that they were still investigating. So the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office were constructing another version of what they thought went down between 12:30 and 1:50 a.m. In their opinion, Lucille had undertaken a plan that failed. They believe she planned to stop the car on the road, spread gasoline over her drugged husband, and with a stick on the accelerator, gently walk the car over the embankment where it would tumble down the retaining wall into the lemon grove and explode. If this happened, she kind of was like, "Then I'll just walk the 2 miles back to my house and I'll be home before the accident is even discovered." So they think her plan was to not even act like she was going to get milk. It was all her husband. But they think what happened was the plan went awry. And according to them, when the car didn't go over the embankment in order to fall, she panicked. She's like on this dark road. She decides to pour gasoline everywhere. And she's kind of at this point thinking someone could drive by at any moment, so I need to get this fire going, and that she just set the fire herself instead of waiting for the car to explode. This would account for some of the odd physical evidence the detectives discovered. They said the car was in a low gear because she was just starting it from a dead stop. It wasn't speeding down a road. There was parking lights on, and they said, "Oh, she probably needed that to have some light to start the fire." And then all those wheel marks in the dirt or whatever were because she kept trying to push the car back and forth to get over the embankment and just couldn't. And then obviously the milk cartons being upright was because there was no sudden stop where they fell over.
Well, wouldn't they eventually fall over
when she's trying to push it?
When she's trying to push it?
No, they were stubborn. Those milk cartons would not fall over. I have no idea. Yeah. I mean, this is just them speculating. It's all speculation.
Right.
There's no real evidence. And this is like before there was like tire mark experts and
right.
all of those kind of experts who would come in and take molds of everything, whatever.
I have a question. Have they determined at this point, or has she given an explanation to why the car jerked? Because she said the car suddenly like jerked
yeah.
to one side.
Not yet.
Okay.
I'm actually about to say it right now.
Okay.
So there were some physical evidence that did support her story. One thing is there was a nail in the front tire. So they speculated it's possible the tire kind of blew out. Mm-hmm. And that's why she jerked over. She also had claimed to have tried to break the window open with a rock, and they did find a huge rock by the car, which doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it was there, sort of confirming that part of her story. Within a few days, an autopsy established that Gordon Miller was alive when he burned, and that he had enough Nebutal and Sandoptal in his blood to put the average person to sleep. Now, as I mentioned, this is not unusual because he habitually took both Nebutal and Fiorenol, which is a headache prescription that contains Sandoptal. So it wasn't like Lucille would have had to drug him. He was taking these medications regularly. Now, a good defense attorney could easily make the case for Lucille's version of the story as well. Like, this is all circumstantial stuff, pretty much. What prosecutors really needed was a motive, and they set out to find one. They pored over accounting ledgers, interviewed neighbors, coworkers, anyone who knew the couple. What would drive this woman who seemingly had it all to basically burn her husband alive? Investigators eventually hit the jackpot when a busybody receptionist at Cork's office hinted at a possibly more selfish motive for the accident. Lucille had been having an affair.
Oh my God.
In the documentary, the woman, she's like, well, she like looks around.
Wait, they have the busybody?
Well, it's a reenactment.
Oh.
But she's like, well, like, come closer. Like,
yeah.
Like, she knew some shit. So with that tip, investigators were able to turn up falsified motel records and more. It seemed that in December of 1963, Lucille Miller found a ray of sunshine in her grim life, a reason to once again have hope that she could achieve the sunny California dream after all. We'll take a break here and come right back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Lucille probably couldn't help herself. She fell for a man who was in every way the polar opposite of her husband. Arthwell Hayton was such a catch. He was successful. He was a lawyer in San Bernardino. He was well-liked and fun. He was also married. Investigators managed to turn up accounts and evidence, not only of these motel stays, but lunches. There were sightings of the pair in Art's Cadillac convertible. And there were those Lucille confided to about the affair, including her daughter and Sandy Slagle.
Oh my God.
So Sandy would later say that she knew everything, and she knew every time, place, and everything, every time they fucked. She knew it all. And very quickly it came out that all these sort of details started coming up and popping in trashy magazines of the day. Like, this was a big story at the time.
Yeah.
So any little trashy newspaper articles in LA area, and it actually went national as well. They loved this affair stuff. They were eating it up. So, and some of these things would come out were Lucille's own words, because they found letters, notes. There were recordings that people made.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, of Lucille talking about?
Yes. Yes.
What did they record it on?
I don't fucking know. Amateur people, they got their fucking little tape recorder and started recording things.
1964.
Yeah.
What
people? Well, I don't know. You argue with this guy who got the recording. I don't know. Like, I think it was one of those things though, where people had the movie cameras and stuff. Like,
but that's not very conspicuous or inconspicuous.
I don't know why he did it either. I'll get to him later.
Oh, so it's a specific person,
yes,
who said, "I have a recording of her talking about,
yes,
fucking this
he
guy."
Recorded her. Like, and I have no idea why he recorded her, because this was pre-murder or pre-death.
Right.
He was just recording her like, this is juicy. Because I guess she was talking to him all the time.
And
I don't know.
She didn't notice him with his little fucking camera?
No, because it was on the phone.
Oh.
It was just audio.
Okay. I was imagining him like trying to be...
No,
inconspicuous with his fucking 1964 technology.
No, he did it on the phone. Like, he had one of those things that hooked to the phone. Like, that little fucking, like,
this
whatever, suction cup. Yeah. So...
this guy's a freak.
No. So some of the accounts that were in these magazines was an incident where Lucille was at Harold's Club in Fontana with with Artwell or whatever for lunch one day, and he was trying to kiss her, and she's like, don't kiss me, it will trigger things. So people ate that up. And then I said there were notes, one from Artwell that said, hi sweetie pie, you're my cup of tea, happy birthday, you don't look a day over 29, your baby Artwell.
Oh my god, baby.
I know. There's some other things that come up that make me like think maybe they had a baby thing. So obviously, as affairs often do, this one ends badly and only got worse. See, there was a detail about this affair I didn't mention yet. Artwell was married to one of Lucille's closest friends, Elaine, the woman who died mysteriously just months earlier.
Stop it. Desi, this is a Dateline episode. Yes. I'm serious. This is like 80% of Dateline episodes.
Yeah. Keep finding out these details.
But just this story.
Yeah, totally.
It's always an affair. And then you find out later on, Keith Morrison's like, but wait, there's more. She was also having an affair.
So as I mentioned earlier, back in April of 1964, this woman, Elaine, was alone on a Friday night because her husband, Artwell, had taken his boat out to Catalina that weekend. And Lucille is with her this Friday night. He actually calls Elaine that night, and Lucille's like, she's in the shower. I'll have her call you later or tomorrow or something. The next morning, Lucille leaves, and then the next morning, the Hayton's daughter finds her mother in bed dead. The newspapers reported the death as accidental, perhaps the result of an allergy to hairspray. What? Now, it does turn out that she basically had an accidental drug overdose. She was also on barbiturates and stuff like that, too. So Artwell flies home, obviously, from Catalina. Lucille is the one who meets him at the airport. But this becomes very acrimonious between the two. It had already kind of been festering, and notes between the pair will illustrate how bad things got. So here is Lucille talking to her lover in this early summer of 1964, after he indicated to her that on the advice of his minister, he did not intend to see her anymore. She said, first, I'm going to go to that dear pastor of yours and tell him a few things. Mm. And when I do tell him that, you won't be at Redlands Church anymore.
Ooh.
Look, sonny boy, if you think your reputation is going to be ruined, your life won't even be worth 2 cents.
Damn.
She's pissed. And then Artwell wrote to her, I'll go to the sheriff, Frank Bland, and tell him some things that I know about you until you wish you'd never heard of Artwell Hayton.
Ooh.
So these are two Seventh-day Adventists, and people were kind of like, dude, these Seventh-day Adventists are going off. Like, they couldn't believe like this nasty shit was happening between these kind of like goody-two-shoes supposedly religious people.
Yeah.
So that was definitely an aspect to the scandal.
And these are just like
these are letters.
These are handwritten letters, yes, to each other.
And I mentioned earlier there was recordings between Lucille and one of her confidants. He recorded her just like talking before anything even happened. So this guy's name was Erwin Sprangle. He was a Riverside contractor, a business partner of Arthwell's, and he was friends to both of them. So at some point, he just starts recording her. He has this thing called an induction coil that attaches to your telephone and records phone calls. And I have no idea if this was just something he did to every conversation. Is he a nerd? Like, I don't know why.
He's like, he's just waiting.
He's waiting.
Mr. Sprangle is just waiting for that moment that one of his friends starts like spilling something real juicy.
He's like, I don't know if it's going to happen this call, but I'll be ready. So in this call, she says, boy, I could get that little boy coming and going. He hasn't got one thing on me that he can prove. Meanwhile, I've got concrete things and he has nothing concrete. She also says in this one of these phone calls that she had also recorded Artwell in her car one time without him knowing that she had.
Well, how'd she do that?
I have no idea. So she said, I said to him, Artwell, I just feel like I'm being used. He started sucking his thumb and he said, I love you. This isn't something that happened yesterday. I'd marry you tomorrow if I could. I don't love Elaine. He'd love to hear that playback, wouldn't he? Yeah, said Sprangle on the tape. That would be just a little incriminating, wouldn't it? Just a little incriminating, she said. It really is. Later on the tape, Sprengel asked where Cork was. He took the children down to the church. You didn't go? No. You're naughty.
Wait, Sprengel said that?
Yes!
This guy's a little freak.
He is a freak. He's like, tell me more about the baby stuff. Yeah. I'm almost there. So obviously these are hugely scandalous because this is racy for back then.
And
like, it is creepy.
Super religious people.
Absolutely. So at some point, Lucille and her friend Sandy actually followed Arthwell down to his new boat at Newport Beach, which is quite a drive, if you don't know.
It is.
And they see Arthwell with another girl on the boat. He said they were just drinking hot chocolate and watching TV.
Everybody loves hot chocolate.
Yeah, this is a really... That's like how Seventh-day Adventists go off. They have a hot cocoa.
Yeah.
Because it has a little caffeine in it. You know what I'm saying? So they said that they untied the lines while those people were aboard and just let the boat float off. Yeah. She said, I did that on purpose to save myself from letting my heart do something crazy. Mm. So that was to stop her from going off. So, but did her heart go crazy? Is that what happened on that night of October 7th? The media was eating this story up after the affair was mentioned. And now we have this mysterious death of Elaine. So
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When did Elaine die?
April.
So she died in April, and then 6 months later,
October.
In October,
the husband
dies.
Yeah, so it's pretty close.
Cork.
Did you? I thought you said pork. I was like, no, Cork. Yeah. So they died pretty close to each other.
Okay.
So the trial is set to begin in December. Now, remember, this is like back in the day where things move really fast,
right?
So on the day the jury was supposed to be seated, the San Bernardino Sun-Telegram ran an inside story quoting Assistant District Attorney Don Turner, the prosecutor, as saying, "We're looking into the circumstances of Mrs. Hayton's death now. In the view of the current trial concerning the death of Dr. Miller, I do not feel I should comment on Mrs. Hayton's death, however." So he's basically trying to drop this story to taint the jury pool, because they would not be able to admit this death into the trial.
This is bad.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, there were barbiturates that were found in her blood work at this point. There was some irregularity with the way she was dressed that morning when she was found under the covers. So there was no doubts when she died, but now all of a sudden this guy's dropping all these doubts they have of her death in the paper. Obviously, none of this should have gotten out. And the guy who dropped the story is like, I guess somebody didn't want to rock the boat. These were prominent people, and that's why the story was covered up in the paper. So obviously an immediate mistrial is declared at this point, because you can't do this. But is the damage already done? Almost immediately after this happens, there's another development. The mistrial is declared, and the next day, Arthwell Hayton asked the newspapers to arrive at 11 a.m. for a Sunday morning press conference that he's giving in his office.
Damn.
He asked for television cameras to come. So this is a huge event. Flash bulbs are popping off.
Yeah.
He's like at the podium that he's created. And he says, as you gentlemen may know, there are very often women who become amorous toward their doctor or lawyer. This does not mean on the physician or lawyer's part that there is any romance toward the patient or client. Reporter asked, would you deny that you were having an affair with Mrs. Miller? He says, I would deny that there was any romance on my part whatsoever.
Come on.
So basically, but it's kind of like one of those omission lies where it's like, so you fucked, but you didn't love her.
Right.
Right? Like, because he's like, there was no romance.
He's been a lawyer.
And Lucille is obviously pissed because she's like, he said he loved me and didn't love Elaine. Like, she has a completely different version, which happens sometimes.
Right.
He's just a liar. So January 11th, 1965, the Miller trial officially begins. The crowds are so bad at the trial that they actually break the glass courtroom doors. They're like shatter at this rush of people coming in.
Dude.
The line begins forming to get in at 6 a.m. And some college girls camp out at the courthouse all night to get seats to this trial. They wanted to see Arthwell and Lucille, who would arrive against her lawyer's advice with her hair piled high and fully lacquered.
Mm.
So she was like, I'm going to work.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring it. Her lawyer, who was named Edward P. Foley, Joan Didion describes him as a small, emotional Irish Catholic who would weep during several moments during the courtroom.
Dude, I'd be
court
like,
trial.
I'd be like, can you please calm down? Seriously. This is my life.
He says, I would have been happy if she came in with her hair hanging loose, but Lucille wouldn't do that. She has a great honesty, this woman, but this honesty about her parents always works against her. So spectators also got something even better than the hair, though, when Lucille arrived to court. She arrives wearing maternity clothes.
Uh-oh.
She's pregnant.
Uh-oh.
3.5 months pregnant. And the prosecutors, that this really puts a wrench in their plans of asking for the death penalty, because no one's going to put a pregnant woman to death. So they basically have to throw that out right away and switch it over to life in prison. So adding now to the motive, you know, they have the affair, obviously. Prosecutors also have something else. Further investigation has led them to the discovery of a $125,000 life insurance policy with a double indemnity clause for accidental death. So now they have this money as well. So the prosecutor is making this argument that she didn't just want her freedom and alimony. She wanted everything. She was a woman motivated by love and greed. She was a manipulator, and she's a user of all people. Her attorney, Edward Foley, he presents another side of Lucille. He says Lucille was a blabbermouth. She would never be able to hide a secret because she told everyone about the affair. She even blabbed to the police about the affair in her initial interviews with like the guy who was on the scene. It just never was translated immediately.
No, this is honestly my favorite kind of defense attorney. The one who's like, Your Honor, my client is a dumbass.
Yeah.
They could not have done this.
It's very believable.
When they kind of like throw shade at their client.
Yeah. They're like, look, I mean, I could believe he was guilty because he's so dumb. Like,
right.
Yeah, it's just like, so she's on tape, like with this initial officer. This is like the morning before she's arrested. And she's saying on tape, of course, Cork lived with it for years. You know, after Elaine died, he pushed the panic button one night and asked me right out. And I think was when he really kind of first came to face it. So she's
Wait.
Like,
so she was like hinting at the affair.
No, I think he was suspicious, but when Elaine died, he finally asked her out and out, like, are you sleeping with Arthwell? And she's like, yep, you got me. Like,
right. But I'm saying she was hinting at this to the officers on the scene.
I mean, she was saying it. She wasn't even hinting at it.
So the defense attorney was saying because she's a blabbermouth, she couldn't have done it.
Right. She would have told people
that she had done it.
That she had done it.
Right.
Because she has
okay.
all this confidence and she doesn't really keep secrets. When the sergeant asked why she had agreed to talk to him against instructions by her lawyers not to, she said, oh, I've always been quite an honest person. I mean, I can put a hat in the cupboard and say it costs $10 less, but basically I've always just kind of lived my life the way I wanted to. And if you don't like it, you can take off, which I guess is fuck off for Adventist.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of witnesses, kind of character witnesses for Lucille, including Debbie, the 14-year-old daughter. She testified about how she and her mother had gone to the supermarket to buy the gasoline can the week before the accident. And she also kind of threw her mom under the bus. She said her mom was always running out of gas because she was a total dingbat.
Mm.
There was also Sandy Slagle in the courtroom every day, declaring that at least one occasion, Lucille had prevented her husband not only from committing suicide, but from doing it in such a way that it would appear to be an accident and ensure a double indemnity payout. 2 months drag on and the headlines never let up. But finally, on March 2nd, after the prosecutor reiterated that it was a case of love and greed and Foley protested that his client was being tried for adultery, the case went to the jury. They brought in a verdict guilty of murder in the first degree at 4:50 p.m. on March 5th. Debbie, the daughter, was in the courtroom. She started screaming, she didn't do it. She didn't do it. Her mom is actually like, shh, we don't act that way in public.
Oh my God.
Sandy Slagle collapsed in her seat and began to scream. And Lucille also scolded her, saying, God, for God's sakes, please, like, calm down. Slandy Slagle was also subdued by courtroom officers, but as the jurors left the courtroom, she screamed again at them, "You're murderers. Every last one of you is a murderer." I don't know why she said that, because she didn't get the death penalty. Anyway, Lucille's children would go live with Harold and Joan Lance, and she would have her daughter while incarcerated, Kimmy, who would tragically die of lung cancer at age 25.
Oh, my God.
So Lucille spent 7 years in prison and was paroled in 1972. So she didn't go very long. And according to her daughter, Debbie, she told this wild story. She said, if she wasn't a criminal before she went to prison, prison turned her into one. She would use her children to supply her with contraband. They would bring in alcohol and drugs when they would take visits to see her so she could run this illicit drug supply operation in prison.
Dude, these poor kids.
No, the kids were fucked. So she and Debbie was also sneaking in Lancôme makeup for her. Debbie said in an interview that her mom never explicitly said, "Don't bother coming if you don't bring my shit." But it was basically implied she wouldn't see them if they didn't bring her stuff.
Right.
So after she's paroled, Debbie basically is at her mom's beck and call. They do move to Hollywood eventually. She follows her mom and basically moves wherever the mom moves around. She never really gets a legitimate income. Once she's released, she kind of does a lot of scammy things. And she eventually dies of breast cancer, estranged from her children in 1986. Now, it's at her funeral that Debbie says she first started letting herself think that her mom might be guilty.
Wow.
An interesting story she tells about something that happened at the funeral. She said she was talking to that old family friend I mentioned, Sandy Slagle, about some items that she found at her mother's that she thought might belong to Sandy. Sandy was shook when she said this because she said those items match ones that were stolen from my home in a burglary years ago. Sandy Whoa. Described being suspicious that her friend Lucille was the one who robbed her and even gave Lucille one last chance to confess on her deathbed, but Lucille never copped to it. And Debbie wondered what other secrets her mom took to the grave with her, because she didn't even like cop to this, which is like whatever she stole from her friend, which sucks, but like just say it, right? Maybe like in your last moments. Now, Debbie talks about how she went on to battle addiction. She does eventually get sober and she becomes an English teacher. But her past is constantly haunting her because this essay by Joan Didion is a very popular piece of literature and it's used in numerous curriculums across California. So wow. She's always being confronted with this essay and like, she's afraid she's going to get busted. Like, I'm the daughter in that story. Like,
yeah.
And she doesn't want to deal with it. She says, "My mother hated Didion's essay and taught her children to hate it too. She believed it was Didion's revenge on her for turning down an interview request. Whether it was or not, I think my mother made a huge mistake refusing to talk to her because Didion would have probably found her to be a sympathetic character." At some point, she finally reads it again, and this time it's without her mom's bias. She wrote, "It had caused me to keep silent about my past, interfere in my colleagues' curriculum decisions out of fear what could happen to me. And I finally saw that Didion's descriptions of us, where we lived, and my mother were in fact spot on. I was an adult and my mother was dead and I was free to have my own opinions. My burdens were finally lifted." So she writes Joan Didion and Joan Didion responds. She also sends her a book with a poem earmarked for Debbie. It is by Philip Larkin. And the poem starts off this way. "They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extras just for you." So she says that when she heard Joan Didion died, that there was a very personal loss for her because the essay, she says, actually ended up making her who she is today. So now she is trying to tell her own story. I mentioned earlier she is in the process of writing a memoir about this. But it's obviously a very difficult process to go through. She has called her mother the most wonderful, terrible person she's ever known. And it's really sad to hear her talk about writing this book because she's like, "I realized my mom is actually the interesting one and not me. I always wanted her all to myself. And while writing this book, I do have her all to myself finally. But I know when I'm finished with the book, she'll finally be gone forever."
Oh, that's so sad.
I know. It's such a tortured relationship.
I mean, I feel bad for Debbie and these kids because right from the start, the mom put so much on these kids when they were young. They were children. She's like telling her about her affair, making her keep these secrets and about helping, you know, it's like her responsibility, making it her responsibility to protect the dad from,
oh my God,
from taking his own life.
No, when I initially was reading about this case, I was kind of like, yeah, it could go either way. But when I started reading Debbie's personal accounts, I was like, her mom is a malignant narcissist.
Right.
Like, this is not a good woman.
Right.
Like, so I started thinking like, yeah, maybe she did do it because she's not great. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I just kind of like hearing her stories were just really like triggering to hear for me in particular. But it was just like, she did not have your best interest at heart.
And like, it's so sad because I get the daughter's point of view where it's, that's her only mother. That's her mom. And she obviously is going to have some kind of like a bond with her, a natural bond and love aspects of her. It's just, but she does seem like a malignant narcissist.
Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty textbook to me. Just
even
these
the stealing
things.
Stuff, the stealing.
She just doesn't give a shit about anyone, but she wants them all to worship her. Like,
right.
And it's just like, no, it was sad to me because I feel like, you know, Debbie's obviously in her 70s now and just, she never had this opportunity. Like maybe people today would be like, I don't have to be with my mom if she's that way.
Right.
Like you didn't have that opportunity back then. You had to be with your mom. You had to follow her around and help her. Do you know what I mean? Like nowadays I think people have more tools to recognize that it's okay to like set boundaries.
And it's okay to have, to choose your family.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
okay to choose your family.
You're not a bad daughter if you cut that woman out. Like,
right.
Like,
no, I feel bad. She's like still dealing with this into her 70s.
I really hope she finishes her book. Like yeah. I said, her essays that I read were very touching to me. Like, I thought she was a good writer. There's a lot more there that I don't go into about their family life. That was not great. Like it yeah. was a pretty fucked up situation for those kids to be living in. But all of the kids seem to have done well with their lives and gotten on. So,
and Debbie's sober now.
Yeah. And she's, I think, you know, I think it's good for her to like, she has nothing to be ashamed about.
No.
So, and she did have like some great moments with Joan Didion at the end before Joan died. Like, Joan seemed really kind to her and helped push her into being a writer, I think.
That's
so
sweet.
Yeah. So you can find the essay online. I like Joan Didion's writing a lot, so you should read it all. But this essay you can find if you just want to look into that. But yeah, that's the story.
I can't believe I never knew that story.
I had seen things about it, but I didn't know if it was enough for an episode.
Yeah.
And then when I found all of Debbie's writings, I was like, oh, I can fill it out more now. And yeah. I didn't realize there was all this other stuff with the affair.
Wow. Wow. What a yeah. story, Desi. That was so interesting. Anyway, you can find all of our episodes ad-free on Patreon, patreon.com/HollywoodCrimeScene. As well as hundreds of bonus episodes that are not available on this feed.
Yeah.
If you want movie recaps, reality show recaps, episodes about things that do not fit into the Hollywood or LA parameters.
Yeah.
You can find those at patreon.com/HollywoodCrimeScene. We will have a link in the show notes. And we will see you later this week for our mini episode.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.